This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
Hello and welcome to this week's show of Property Matters. I'm Greg Watson. This is a show where we talk all things property, or at least as much as we can fit into this relatively short format. Today we're going to be talking about a number of things with regards recent comments about whether property is worthwhile investing in, or whether Kiwis should be changing to look in other areas. There's a few articles on that assorted from around the internet. We've also got a number of bad tenant, bad landlord type articles and that sort of thing. It's always interesting to see what tenants may do and what landlords may do in properties and what is done about that officially. So that's quite a bit as well. Also, the Lion Man, the former home of the Lion Man, is for sale up in Whangarei. We'll talk a little bit about that. And also Kiwi Kitchens being on a shortlist for international prizes. We'll talk a little bit about that too. So here we go. Let's start with the former home of the Lion Man from the TV series from a number of years back. And, of course, that's in Whangarei. It's a nice photo here, this article by Poppy Clark on Stuff. The property was previously known as Zion Wildlife Gardens Limited up until 2011, when it was reborn as Kamo Wildlife Sanctuary. And it's actually 32.5 hectares. For those of you who are slightly unsure what that means, think of rugby fields. It's about 32.5 rugby fields. So Bailey's describes the property as well-developed and thoughtfully laid out, with essential amenities like an office ablution block and a range of secure enclosures or shelters, ideal for animal housing, a pet motel or other commercial applications. The barn on the property has three bedrooms and a self-contained studio cottage. What's interesting about this place also is that subdivision consent has been granted for four lots, providing immediately potential for development or investment. So I would assume that means that you'd be able to sell off some of that land to recoup some of the purchase price. So this show was the show that Craig Bush was involved in. He had some notoriety from the Lion Man show and so forth. However, the park did get eventually closed down. Looking at these kitchens, Kiwi Kitchens, that are doing well on an international basis. It's nice to see that we are producing some of the most fantastic kitchens around. This particular article by Colleen Hawkes, if you did want to look it up, the title is Mad Hatter's Tea Party, one of nine Kiwi kitchens on shortlist. So these are in the Kiwi designers have taken 9 out of the 10 places in the final of the SBID Australasia Kitchen Design Final. So there we go. Kiwis slightly on top of the Aussies in this one. So there we are. And there's a couple of designers that each have two kitchens on the shortlist. Now, why this article is interesting is that it's got pictures of all of the different kitchens. So again, this is on stuff.co.nz. A wide variety there. I know that I'm always interested in seeing what little gadgets and extra bits and pieces you can fit into kitchens these days. There has been some amazing developments in recent years of where you can get extra storage, mechanisation, sometimes smart home features and so forth. And a wide range of winning or finalists here. A lot of them have natural stone kitchen bench tops, very, very beautiful indeed. So 9 out of 10, let's see how we go. Hopefully one of those Kiwis brings home the Australasian awards there for the best kitchen. We're going to talk a little bit about the market now. This article from Susan Edmonds in late July says, New Zealanders urged to break up with property. So is it time to consider selling your property investments and putting the money into assets that actually grow the economy? One investment expert says New Zealand would be a lot better off if such a change were to occur. Jeremy Williamson, head of private wealth and markets at Craigs Investment Partners, said there was momentum building for a move away from a love affair with property and property investing. We think that's great for a number of reasons. New Zealand is always going to have an affinity with property investment, but there are so many benefits for us as a country if we can turn the dial away from it into more productive parts of the economy. He said property investment was not the most efficient way to help create a better life for the next generation of New Zealanders. What does it do on a national scale for us if we're just buying and selling houses back to each other to create wealth? I don't necessarily believe for the collective it works. He said New Zealanders' knowledge about investing in other assets was growing. He says if you put $100 into a New Zealand house 30 years ago, it would be worth nearly $600. But if you put it in New Zealand shares, it would be worth $1,100. He said that people had favoured property investment for the reassurance of being able to touch and see it, but that was changing. He says there is a whole generation of people who got burnt in the 1987 and the share market crash, but the reality is that generation is starting to pass and there is a new generation of people coming through that have had a really positive experience in the asset classes outside of property. He says the ability to leverage a property investment, borrow money from the bank to buy a house with only a 30% deposit, for example, would also make it appealing. But he said, if even 10% of the money being invested into property went into other assets, it would make a big difference. We overallocate to property, we're reinforcing inequality through investment in an asset class that isn't productive, we're inflating that asset class and putting it out of reach for the next generation. If we were to set ourselves an objective, we want a more productive economy, more opportunities for our kids, all that stuff. If we're allocating capital into more productive asset classes, like the tax take from that downstream is going to increase anyway. So that's quite he goes quite a lot more in depth there if you wanted to read the article. That's on Radio New Zealand, rnz.co.nz. And he talks about Infometrics. Chief forecaster Gareth Kennan had some comments on this. He said the average residential property investment return over 10 years to March 2025 was 9.5% per year, including rents and capital gains. Morningstar said the per annum return of typical aggressive KiwiSaver fund over that period was 9.34. So interesting there as well. And which asset class has delivered the best over the past decade? It's actually the Bitcoin asset class had given investors a 45,000% return. However, it is important to point out that during this period, Bitcoin went from being a small speculative asset class to gaining acceptance in the mainstream. That is evidenced by the launch of the ETFs, the inclusion by governments of Bitcoin in their reserves. While it is unlikely that you'll see this type of growth again, it is important to point out that Bitcoin is still a small asset class compared to others, it is only 10% of the value of gold in the world. Anyway, I'm digressing. So let's go back to other articles. This was a follow-up article by Susan Edmonds here to the previous one, saying, property investors, it's not time to break up yet. And she says that calls for New Zealanders to break up with property investment and focus instead on investing in more productive assets such as growth companies are missing the point, says an economist at one property investment firm. So just to recap from a few minutes ago, Jeremy Williamson, the head of private wealth and markets at Craigs Investment Partners, said there was momentum building for a move away from the country's love affair with property and property investing. He pointed that to the returns that were possible from investing in the share market. Remember, he said if you put $100 in housing, you'd get $600 back 30 years later, and in shares, you would have $1,100 back. But Ed McKnight, the property economist at OP's Partners, said that was ignoring the power of leverage. Because people only put a deposit in the purchase of a property and borrow the rest, it can mean bigger returns. If you compare a standard property index or prices to shares, shares increase in value faster than houses. But houses can help you grow your wealth faster than shares. Comes down to the debt, the mortgage. It's a double-edged sword. Whenever you use a mortgage to invest, whether in a house or a business, it makes your returns larger, which can either be good if the value increases or it can be bad if the value decreases. And that's the reason why if you put a 20% deposit into a house and your house value goes down by 20%, you've lost your entire deposit, at least on paper, until the asset recovers in price. But if you put 20% into a house and the value goes up by 20%, you've doubled your money. I call it the mortgage magnifier effect. The bigger the mortgage you use, the larger your return compared to the market return. So your property doesn't go up in value as fast, but it can be a better wealth builder because you can borrow against it. He also said it was not accurate to say that property was not a productive investment. While it would not grow the economy if an investor bought a house and sat on it, he said, people who were buying new were encouraging economic activity. So the builder or developer is taking an older house and building a new one. It drives the economy forward. You have people building houses and nice new warm homes for tenants. So even if you're buying old properties, many investors do them up. That's economic activity, taking something that might be a bit run down and you're improving the quality of New Zealand housing stock. You're spending money at Bunnings or Mitre 10. It means plumbers and electricians can get jobs. It's not true to say property investors don't add anything to the economy. Interesting. He said simply buying and selling existing shares did not add to the economy either, because buying a share in a company doesn't mean the money goes to the company for investment. If you buy a share in the NZME, the money goes to the person I bought the share off, not the company itself. Even in IPOs, the money sometimes goes to the founders. Only a small fraction of my food bags IPO was earmarked for investment. A large part went to paying out the founders. So share investments aren't always as productive as the average reader might think. Though if more people invest in shares, then there is more money available and companies do raise money for further investment. So similarly, property is more productive than non-property people give it credit for. And many investors just don't buy and sell houses. They build new ones or do them up. This improves the housing stock in New Zealand and does not contribute to the higher GDP and a higher standard of living. So there we go, two articles from different perspectives there. You can take from those what you would like. If you've only just tuned in, of course, you can find this on podcasts. Just look for Property Matters and Greg Watson. Next article, this out from Radio New Zealand, home affordability and rent levels improving, according to Massey University. Houses and rents are more affordable as costs fall and consumers benefit from lower interest rates and higher wages, according to new reports from Massey University. National home affordability improved 8.7% in the 3 months up to June, so things are becoming easier to buy, on top of a 9.3% improvement in the first quarter of the year. Report author, Massey Business School and senior lecturer Arshad Javed said a combination of lower borrowing costs and wage growth has helped offset affordability pressures in many regions, even where house prices have stayed high. It's a continuation of a national trend we've been observing over the past year. While there's still regional volatility, the underlying indicators are showing more consistency. So for the quarter, the national median house price was down 1.2% to $763,000. And while an average two-year fixed mortgage rate was 37 basis points lower to 5.66%, weekly earnings were 1.6% higher. So on an annual basis, affordability improved by nearly 27%, with the two-year fixed mortgage down by 1.72%. Percentage points, wages up close to 4%, and a slight fall in the national house price. So all 16 regions recorded an improvement in affordability over the year, with more than 30% in Northland, Manawatu, Whanganui, and Marlborough. So I record the show in Manawatu. And 30% more affordable than what it was a year ago. That's really going to probably have an effect on first home buyers and other buyers coming into the market. So what does he say about this? He says in most of these regions, a combination of price stability or decline, falling mortgage costs and steady income growth contributed to the improvement. For the June quarter, prices rose in half the regions and were unchanged or weaker in the other eight. Javed says the property markets through the country were localised, but overall the picture was one of improving access to home ownership. They also looked at rents as well. So it was a similar story with rents, with higher wages and a fall in rents improving affordability. For the quarter ended March, rental affordability improved by 3.5%, split nearly evenly between a drop in rents and an increase in average weekly incomes. Compared to a year ago, national rentals affordability was slightly improved. But the report noted a widening rent gap between regions. Sorry, I just had a little pop up on my computer there as I was reading. So the report noted a widening rent gap between regions, with 9 of 16 showing improved affordability during the quarter, the highest in Canterbury, Manawatu, Whanganui and Wellington. That's your rental affordability. The most significant decline was Gisborne, where rents surged by 41.2% during the quarter, and smaller increases for Northland, Bay of Plenty, Taranaki and Southland. So it's a timely reminder that affordability is highly localised and needs region-specific responses. On an average annual basis, Gisborne had the biggest decline in rental affordability, but Javid noted that 9 of the 16 regions were still below the annual average. So there we go, easier for people buying, easier for people investing. Although Tony Alexander, economist through the oneroof.co.nz website, had this article here. He says, RIP, New Zealand's mum and dad property investor. So he looks at or analyses some of the main themes running through the residential property market at the moment. First, courtesy of planning rule changes and some overhang from the pandemic binge, there has been a structural shift in the supply of dwellings in New Zealand. Annual consent numbers have averaged 0.65 of the population each year since 1970. And now, after all the pain of tight monetary policy, the pullback in consent issuance has only taken us back to that long-term average and not well below it, as one would have seen in earlier decades. With lots of listings, not much competition, and accumulated savings from years of, until recently, good employment levels, first home buyers are driving the market and have been since the start of 2023. Investors have dipped their toes in the market on occasion over the last 2 years, but they backed off quickly once prices stopped rising. Thirdly, the prices have fallen 2% in the past 4 months and a structural shift in the market is underway in which people's expectations of price growth over the coming years will change. That is, capital gain expectations are pulling away from where they were during the three-decade period until 2021, when interest rates kept edging lower and house production was constrained. Fourthly, the costs of running a rental property business and investing in houses to let has soared. Expenses have stepped much higher for rates, insurance, maintenance and dwelling quality generally, and at the same time, legislation has moved in favour of tenants. Fifth, there is a structural decline underway in the proportion of our population wanting to be property investors. This has been discussed more openly in media and reflects the structural changes noted above and in those articles we talked about earlier in the show, along with a special pressure on rents at the moment because of the fall in net migration flows to below average levels. So Tony Alexander says there are certainly a good number of people who want to purchase property for investment purposes. There always has been. But think of investors as forming a pyramid. The upper layer contains those who have invested in property as a business for generations and may own 20 plus properties. And then there are the layers of those with 10 to 20 or 5 to 10. Below those are 2 to 4. And under that we get those with just one. These latter people have not been property investors in the past, just like their parents were almost certainly not investors. But they've seen the rampant discussion about rapid and easy house price rises and the eye-opening calculations of people making more from their property rising in price than from their wage or salary. These bottom layer people have bought not to run a business long term, but because they felt like they're missing out on something and would look like an idiot if they did not join the in crowd. It is these people who will now look elsewhere, along with some in the next few layers above them, who are finding the numbers don't stack up as well as they did in the past for properties they currently own, and others might normally have rotated their portfolio. So this means two things. One, investor demand for property has structurally stepped lower. Two, many investors with properties are now looking to sell them. That is providing extra stock for first home buyers to peruse and will keep a lid on the prices for the near future. And these factors explain why over 2% falls in mortgage rates this past year have failed to lift prices and why any extra rate cuts from Reserve Bank will not spur the real estate market into life. So quite a lot to digest there, certainly interesting indeed. So now a couple of bad landlord, bad tenant stories. So this first one from Stuff. And the headline is something else. It says, students emptied buckets through the night after raw sewage poured from kitchen ceiling. this article on Stuff Amy Rideout. So it says, when raw sewage began pouring through the kitchen ceiling, a student flat took turns emptying a bucket through the night. The landlord didn't send a plumber until the next day and then ignored the tenant's request for compensation and to end their tenancy. A tribunal ruling from adjudicator Kate Lash said the students moved into the Kelburn apartment managed by Property Management Wellington in November 2024. They contacted their property manager in early April about a few maintenance issues, including the kitchen ceiling, which was bowing. The landlord's contractor told the students the ceiling was not an issue. But the next day, sewage began leaking from the ceiling, the deluge ramping up over the evening. The tenants had to empty approximately two buckets of raw sewage every 2 hours over the course of the night, said Lash. The following day, the landlord sent a plumber who repaired a burst pipe and removed contaminated ceiling and flooring. The cleaner cleaned and dried the kitchen, but the smell was strong. Tenants moved out for a few weeks, and upon their return, they were given use of kitchen and an empty unit upstairs. However, they quickly realised that kitchen wasn't fully functional. With the exception of 1 week, the tenants continued to pay rent. When they asked their property manager for a rent rebate, they were refused and asked to pay the missing week's rent. In mid-April, the tenants asked to end the tenancy. When they didn't get a response, they served their landlord with a 14-day notice. The case went to the tribunal where the tenants were asked to terminate their tenancy, or a tenant asked to terminate their tenancy and wanted compensation for rent and food lost. Lash said the students had lost faith and trust in their landlord, who had failed to communicate or keep promises. They suffered uncertainty and anxiety as they tried to navigate the situation while studying. One tenant had suffered respiratory issues as a result of the incident and the mould that appeared afterwards. He had sent the landlord a medical note, but this had been ignored, which was extremely distressing. Although the landlord agreed some compensation was necessary, they did not consent to ending the tenancy early, saying the work on the flat was not grounds for termination. However, Lash, the adjudicator, disagreed, saying the landlord had failed to address problems. The landlord was given multiple opportunities to engage with tenants, put into place a rent reduction, provide compensation, advise them of timeframes and acknowledge their concerns, but they did not. Lash said an AI-generated apology, emailed to the tenants by the property manager, indicated a lack of care and attention. She agreed to end the tenancy and awarded the tenants $300. She considered this appropriate as the tenants had had a week's rent abatement already and the flat was now empty and a flat market a problem for the landlord. The tenants were granted name suppression, but the landlord was not. I consider it in the public interest to be aware of the name of this company given the way they've dealt with this situation. So there we go. Landlords, be careful. You can be called out for bad behaviour. This next article here is from the New Zealand Herald by Catherine Hutton. It says, landlord finds squalid home, tenant Jessica Michelle Duffy ordered to pay. A landlord's final inspection of a house revealed some surprises, including baseball bats and chains under the beds and couches, modifications to the garage, and a flatmate still living there with his dog. The landlord, whose name is suppressed, provided the tenancy tribunal with photographs of the house to show tenant Jessica Michelle Duffy made no attempt to clean it before she left it in February this year. The landlord described the state of the house as squalid, which the tribunal accepted. Cupboards were still full, dishes were piled in the sink, the bathroom still had personal items, furniture was still in all the rooms, and the woodshed was piled with a tremendous amount of rubbish. Baseball bats and chairs were found under the beds and couches. The wood burner was loaded with the remnants of burnt aluminium cans and glass bottles. Man, that's terrible. What a mess. The bathroom required an immediate application of exit mould and personal items removed with gloves before being considered hygienic enough for occupancy and professional cleaners. And during an inspection on January 28th, the landlord also discovered a missing downpipe and a broken window in one of the rooms. Despite being asked in writing to make repairs before mid-February, Duffy made no effort to do so, the decision said. In another room, four large rectangles had been cut into the carpet, destroying it. The carpet also had suspected paint stains that would not be removed. So as well as the damaged carpets, there was a strong smell of cigarettes, ash and dog throughout all the rooms. And as a result, the landlord decided to replace the carpet and sought a contribution from the tenant. The garage had been heavily carpeted and the walls and windows boarded up and lined with underlay and black material. And while the flatmate removed the wall lining, an extensive quantity of boards, material, carpet, underlay, rubbish and personal effects remained in the garage. The garage door was also broken and had to be replaced because it had been levered open. So the recently released decision also noted that because the keys weren't returned, the locks had to be replaced and the lawn needed to be mowed. So in its decision, the tribunal accepted the landlord's claim that the clean-up required two skip bins and many hours of stressful and disgusting work, shifting the tenant's rubbish and possessions, although the decision notes the flatmate also helped. Taking into account betterment and depreciation, the tribunal ordered that Duffy, who didn't attend the hearing, pay $4,822 to the landlord for the costs that they'd incurred. That included rent arrears, rubbish removal, replacing carpet, curtains and repairs to the window and downpipe, garage door and replacement locks. So, heck, what a mess. That tenant's going to be, you know, when you have a debt like that, of course, you can lodge it with debt collection agency, and that's going to be hanging around after that tenant for quite some time. But it certainly sounds like there was no respect for that house. There are photos, and I can assure you that they're not very pleasant at all on New Zealand Herald. You could probably look up the keywords squalid home if you wanted to see what that looks like. So that's all we've got time for this week on Property Matters. It's been wonderful having your company today. Thank you for the team at Manawatū People's Radio who helped produce this show. You can find some back issues on mpr.nz. But also, if you wanted to subscribe, I'd love that. Just go to wherever you find your podcasts and search for Greg Watson and Property Matters. Thanks again to the team, and have a wonderful week.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.